It's Marketplace Tech for November 19th. I'm Ben Johnson in New York. We are about to find out today if Wall Street is going to swipe right on dating apps. Match Group, which owns digital romance companies like Tinder, OkCupid, and Match.com, is headed to the NASDAQ to trade as MTCH. Earnings rose 17% at the company last year. How will it do on the ticker? Depends on the pressure. Melvin Backman is finance reporter at Quartz.
Once you do kind of bring in this public market element, it suddenly becomes more about what the shareholders want. And what the shareholders want is they want to make money on their investments. You know, the company might start making changes that people don't like, which is something that you hear about with Twitter.
Some have also pointed out that if Match Group's products make lasting love connections, its 59 million users may dwindle. Headed uptown from Wall Street, I visited the New York Historical Society the other day. There, I met Chief Curator Stephen Edenden, who introduced me to a new exhibit that explores the connection between the world of the personal computer and the Big Apple.
It's called Silicon City, and it's the history of computerization in New York.
Who knew?
Exactly. But, you know, it started here in the early 19th century, and it's still going strong today.
Okay, so you and I are standing next to a machine that is, I don't know when it comes from, but it's a massive desk-shaped thing. It's chrome-ish, and it has about a gazillion switches on it, and I really want to flip all the switches, and it's got a bunch of dials, too. What is this thing?
Well, this is the SSEC. It's a truly Star Wars-type computer from 1948, developed by IBM at Watson Labs at Columbia, and then put into the IBM building at 57th and Madison in New York.
What does it do?
Well, it computed. It was one of the great sort of first electronic computers, major computers of the period that was used for all sorts of specific tasks. It multiplied, it added, it did all sorts of things.
So it's like a fifth grader.
It's a very fancy fifth grader, yes.
Is part of this also about the connection between the financial industry and the computing industry here in New York?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're saying about New York is that it was the center on many levels since the 19th century, and finance is key to it. Banks like Citibank, which go back to the 19th century, worked with firms like IBM, and they worked within a small area of Manhattan. You didn't have to drive anywhere to talk to your colleagues. You just walked down the block, and it's a major, major part of what makes New York a really important place.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Each week over the next several weeks, we are bringing you special content alongside our new podcast called Codebreaker. And one of the things we talk about is how pornography gets sorted on free so-called tube sites, where adult content gets tagged with keywords for easier searching. Some of those categories are race-based, Asian or ebony, how to separate a fetish from promoting sexual stereotypes. Marketplace's Tobin Lowe looked at the historical precedent of racial categorization in adult content. Hi, Tobin.
Hey, Ben.
So you've been looking into how adult content and films are organized on the internet with tagging and categories, stuff like that. There's a separate category for fetishes or body types. Often race gets singled out as well here. So is that the internet's fault?
Well, the short answer is definitely not.
Okay.
So pornography, as long as it's existed, it's been sorted into categories, and that includes separating by race. But what's interesting is the reasoning has changed over the years. So if we're talking about the 20s and 30s when pornography was illegal, that's mostly sold in the back rooms of certain bookstores. And sorting the materials into really clear categories was about avoiding having to say out loud what you were looking for. I talked to Murray Miller Young. She wrote a book about how black women have been portrayed in pornography. She said she actually found these pamphlets.
Distributors and producers writing to instruct retailers that they should organize their stock in particular ways that were going to facilitate the discretion and convenience of the customer. And that included along lines of race.
And I should mention that a lot of these categories and ways that black performers are referred to were very racist.
And we still see some of this today on the internet with adult content. Are producers to blame here?
Well, if we're talking about tube sites, where material is being tagged by keywords, those really started as a place for users to upload homemade content. And eventually they evolved into a place where fans uploaded other people's videos illegally. And that means the tags are a reflection of how the uploader sees the content. This is Jack Shimama. He's worked in the adult film industry for about 12 years.
And so as a result, some of the tagging, some of the, you know, like the keyword tagging or the hashtagging that goes on isn't going to be as elaborate or as detailed with the producers as it is with the fans who are uploading stuff.
So something you talk about on this week's episode of Codebreaker is how these films kind of get reinterpreted via the tags and titling when the users put videos up on the sites.
Right. And in some cases, it's as harmless as pointing out the actors have beards or look like hipsters. But in other cases, some of these films are reduced to titles and tags that only see race. And in some cases, they use tags that are just outright racist. So even though the industry kind of birthed these categories for pornography, you have to question what it means when the users are also viewing the material in this really problematic way.
Tobin's longer story is in this week's episode of Codebreaker. Tobin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Get Codebreaker on iTunes or your usual podcasting app, or you can unlock all of the episodes of this season early at codebreaker.codes. I'm Ben Johnson, and that's our show today. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.